Once the family relationship was put into existence, and the assumption was that that's where children would be born, and the assumption was that parents would train their children and take care of them, and that it would be the love and affection which parents have for children which would guide and determine what kind of care and treatment they would be given. Are you think about that for just a moment and think of how many expressions will come to your mind, like blood is thicker than water, and the family is the foundation stone of civilization, and the rest of those kinds of feelings that we have, that somehow or other the family units, people related to each other by blood and related to each other by the legality of marriage, or the, for some faiths, the sacrament of marriage, that we ought to protect that relationship, and then that relationship will take care of the people who are in it. So we had that puzzle last Wednesday as to whether or not we ought to be particularly interested in trying to protect individuals, people, persons, individuals, or whether we ought to be trying to protect institutions and then let the institutions do the job for us. We use family institution to solve a great number of problems. The distribution of property, the provision of social security, the implementation of our tax laws, the rights of judgment creditors to take or not to take property, exemptions, and so down through a long, long list of specific answers that we get by asking who's related to whom. In more recent years, we in the United States and in the Western world generally have thought more highly of individual freedom and individual protection and less highly of community relationships and groupings and institutions. And if I may digress for just a moment by way of illustration of what I'm trying to talk about this morning, this shows up in places other than the family. For example, if you will think about the discussions which our president, President Carter, has been having in recent months with people who are heads of governments in Eastern Europe and in Russia about human rights. Mr. Carter has faulted Russia, for example, for the imprisonment of individuals without trial, saying that this denial of liberty without appropriate trial is a violation of human rights. No matter what your law says over there, that's a violation of the right of a human being, says our president. And I think that most Westerners would feel that way, that we are, in the words of our Declaration of Independence, endowed by our Creator with certain, the words in the Declaration are unalienable. I like to say inalienable, it feels better on the tongue somehow or other. That we are, by creation, God has made human beings, human rights, with certain basic characteristics which simply cannot be taken away from us, and that among these is liberty, freedom. So we think of that as being part of a human being. Yet I think all of us know that the history of the Hebrew, the Jew, was a history which emphasized the community of God, the people. We are God's people. We are His community. We are in the building called Koinonia, the fellowship. And most of the Eastern world today thinks that mankind is better off if we emphasize those communities, the gatherings. The family is held in much higher respect in Eastern Europe and in Russia than it is in the United States.
I believe in Mexico, too, at least the Mexican parents take care of their children.
Yes.
And love their children.
Because the concept of the individual's rights, you know, my rights, my rights, my rights, which we tend to emphasize so much in the United States, is subordinate to the notion of the right of the people. In Mexico, yes. Or in Eastern Europe, yes. So we're caught up in that problem here, and we're going to see it again today. I would like to start by telling you about Mr. Weber and somebody called Stokes. Mr. Weber was a married man. He had four children. He and his wife had four children. Mr. and Mrs. Weber were not living together. Mr. Weber was living with May Stokes. They were not married to each other. They couldn't be. He was married to Mrs. Weber. Nonetheless, they were living together and they had a child. So Mr. Weber and Miss Stokes and the four Weber children and the one Weber Stokes child, the child born to Mr. Weber and Mrs. Stokes when they were living together without the benefit of marriage, were living in a household. Mr. Weber was working, he was employed, and he was supporting himself, sending a check to his wife, who was not living there, supporting Miss Stokes and supporting the five children. Mr. Weber was killed in an industrial accident. The law provides that when a person is wrongfully killed, when a person who is providing for the support of certain persons is killed, that those persons have been deprived of support to which they are entitled, and they have a cause of action to recover. The four Weber children, under the law of Louisiana, that's where this action arose, were able to get wrongful death compensation because Mr. Weber was their legitimate, lawful father. That is, they were the product of a marriage. The Stokes-Weber baby, the one who was born not to a man and a woman who were married to each other. No question about who the Stokes child's parents were, Mr. Weber and Miss Stokes. Everybody knew that. Somebody representing, Mrs. Stokes representing her child, said, "This child also needs support. This child has also lost the support of its loving father. And this child surely has a cause of action against the people who wrongfully caused the death of the father." And the defendant in the action answered, the defendant being an industrial insurance company, answered by saying, "Ah, but that child had no legal right to be supported. And therefore, the death of the father, although it has removed a person who was caring and providing support, but that was simply an act of grace on his part. He did that because he wanted to. He didn't have to. He was not the lawful, legitimate parent." Do you understand what I'm saying? And therefore, by wrongfully causing the death of Mr. Weber, that child was not deprived of any legal right and therefore has no legal remedy for a legal wrong. Now, if we had lots of time, we could go back and read the fifth chapter of Galatians again. It's one thing to live in a spirit of grace and freely do good for other people. It's another thing to claim legal rights. Last night you people were very patient with me while I taught you all about the Fifth Amendment and the 14th Amendment. And we talked about the fact that it's unconstitutional to deprive people or to deny people equal protection of the laws. I would like to know from you now how well you learned your lessons. Was the Weber Stokes child denied equal protection of the law if the four legal children are given a cause of action for loss of rights and the illegitimate child is not given a cause of action for rights? Is that a denial of equal protection, or to ask my question slightly differently, is that classification of legal children, legitimate children, and illegitimate children, bastards, is that an irrational and an unconstitutional discrimination, so that the 14th Amendment would apply, and so that the Louisiana statute limiting the right of recovery only to legitimate children would be invalid?
Sounds like an immoral class.
Yeah, but it's not wrong legally unless the law would be changed that would include bastards. Morally, I feel as a child should have support, but legally, no.
And the law, of course, does not enforce purely spiritual things.
No.
The law cannot enforce grace and love and happiness. I do not expect ever to see a person redeemed, saved by law. Ever. I do not believe that you can force, by threat of imprisonment, a person to be godly. We can sure make the rascals scream if they drive too fast, or if they steal property, or if they do some other illegal act. But are you not uncomfortable by saying that two children who didn't control the circumstances of their birth, one born to a man and a woman who were married, and one born to a man and a woman who were not married, aren't you uncomfortable legally, aside from the good part of Galatians, God's Spirit?
Nothing is said about bloodline, as far as legality.
Louisiana said, not every child in the world can claim a right to recover if a person is killed. There have to be some classifications of who can sue and who can't. And that classification, said Louisiana, has to be built on only those who can be classified as being entitled to have that right. Bloodlines, legitimate bloodlines, is what Louisiana said. And the Stokes argument was, why not just blood? Why does it have to be legal? Well, because if it's not legal, you're not denied legal rights. You don't have any legal action. Oh, now, come on, you're just playing with words, says Stokes. Certainly, the man who was my father owes me. I'm entitled to. He owes me. I have a right. He has a duty. Just by virtue of paternity, the obligation of support, and I am entitled to support. Now, can we justify a delineation which classifies legitimates here, recovery, illegitimates there, no recovery? Now, before you answer that question for me, consider the problems of the relationship between a child and an adult. Who shall inherit the property of a person who dies without a will? Shall any person who is born biologically blood, or shall only those persons who are legitimate children have the right to inherit from the deceased? What persons shall be entitled to support? I mean, child support. Only those persons who are born to a married couple? Or shall we also say that any child born to anybody, married or unmarried, is entitled to be supported? What children shall be given aid for families with dependent children, AFDC? Aid for families for dependent children in the state of Washington is an item which costs about $12 to $14 million a month. One month's AFDC bill is enough to run my law school for several years. Most of those cases are fathers who have gone away. They're not dead. They're just not supporting. Many of them say, well, it's not my child anyway. I'm never married to that mother. All of us taxpayers think maybe they ought to pay support anyway. But fathers in this situation are apt to start talking about things like what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. And saying, you know, if I don't have rights, neither does the child, it's got to be reciprocity. There have to be systems and communities and organizations like the legitimacy of marriage. I'm trying to illustrate the fact that we have a number of problems that are solved by, is the child a child of a family or is it not a child of a family? Tax, inheritance, and down through the long dismal list again. Back to Mr. Weber. There's that poor little Stokes kid there. Weber Stokes' child that needs food, that needs clothing. And if you want to look at it in one way, either Mr. Weber's estate is going to provide for that support, or else you are as a taxpayer. Does that help you make up your mind any? If it does, I'm afraid maybe you were thinking of your pocketbook more than you were thinking of the need of the Weber Stokes child. But maybe that's part of what we have to think about in law also. Then?
You know, I'm just playing with the situation of the child, and I wonder how differently we look at it if that child has also been illegitimate but had never been supported and even cared for by the father.
No,
how would we view the whole case then? It's not part of
this
household.
Right. What if the biological father had never lived with them, but had simply been a one-night stand, as we say? The conception had occurred without any lasting relationship. Would it make a difference to you?
It makes me feel different.
That somehow or other the continuity, the stability, the length of relationship ought to lead us to a different result. What you're working with, ladies and gentlemen, is what's rational, what's helpful, what's functional, what's necessary, what's sensible in a society like ours. And of course, as I'm sure that you sensed last night, that's another way of saying what's constitutional. Constitutional means what's helpful, what's useful, what's workable, what's functional. And we really mustn't think of lawyers' law as being absolute and not subject to change. It is not absolute. It's a relative. Given a bad situation where you have to choose left or right and can't have it both ways, you can't say that only the legitimate children inherit and also the illegitimate, because they're mutually exclusive of each other, you see. Having to choose one or the other, the best we can do with it is to say, what's best? I mean, what seems to work best? They're both kind of bad. But let's choose the lesser of the two evils. And if I can put in a commercial for the legal system now, that's all you're ever going to get, is the lesser of two evils, because law cannot give you the good that you give, that you obtain when you live in the warmth of the trust and the Spirit of God. But unfortunately, man lives in a fallen state, and we must struggle with these limitations that fallen state has placed upon us, and so we use, if I can repeat myself, God's poverty plan for us. Law. It's not so good, but it's better than bloodshed. Sir?
I'm much more at home in words and language than I am in law. But it seems to me you have a contradiction in terms. Now this makes me very heartless. If an illegitimate child or person, let's say person, and yeah. I'm off the hook a little bit,
yes.
has legitimate rights.
Yes.
The German would say that gibt aber nicht, that doesn't agree.
Right. So let's change the word. Let's say that there is no such thing as an illegitimate child, if that will solve our problem. And that's kind of where I'm going in this discussion.
All right.
A number of states have now decided that every child in the world that's born has had two parents, and for some purposes, the relation between that parent and that child are binding legal relationships, like support. That was an easy one to get to. But when we come to inheritance and so forth, then we got to think some more, don't we, Ed?
Haven't you?
I was thinking of another case now. Mr. and Mrs. Weber had four children. Now suppose one of the children was not Mr. Weber, only Mrs. Weber knew that he wasn't.
Yeah.
This child wouldn't get support.
Because we don't know the facts.
Right.
And here we come again to that distinction that we were pointing out last night. The law would be clear. Only those children, the law, the rule, would be that only Mr. Weber's children are entitled to support from Mr. Weber. But if that's not known, if the facts are not known, then there is an error in facts which leads us to a misapplication of the rule. The end process, law is 98% process and at most 2% substance. The end result is that we've made a mistake because of the inadequacy of our fact-determining processes. And what we really got to do is get Miss Weber down there and beat her on the head until she tells us the truth. If she knows. And you would be surprised, maybe you wouldn't be surprised, to know how many children there are in the world today where no one knows who the father is.
Well, even though it's unfortunate for the children, isn't this an injustice that the unwed parents bring upon their children, and it's the unwed parents' responsibility?
Why take it out on the child?
Yeah, but
now, why take it out on the child? Thank you very much for giving me an opportunity to say the next thing. Because at one point in our legal development, we thought that the protection of the legal relationship was so important that illegitimate children, unfortunately, had to suffer in order to protect the concept of a legal family. That to permit illegitimates, sometimes called things like bastards and brush colts and so forth, that to permit them to claim against the interests of those who are related to each other legally would decrease the sanctity, the effectiveness, the protection, and so forth of the unit. And so we didn't tolerate that kind of invasion of the family integrity in order to protect the institution. We valued the institution of marriage very highly. Now you see we are saying, but think of that poor child. Oh, you like to protect individuals more than you like to protect institutions? That's good Western thinking.
You said a while ago that Washington spends about $14 million a month.
12 to 14 a month.
Taking care of children that are
unsupported by their parents, yes. Mm-hmm.
And I suppose one could say that every state in the Union is doing the same thing.
Yes.
have we not then by practice practically developed at least a point of view that gets close to being rule or law, but not on the record, that when there is a child born out of wedlock, or in some other way is deprived of the attention of one of the parents, then the state steps in to see that it is provided the kind of help that makes it possible for the mother to carry on. And that I think that's a more rational way of handling it, because you're a little more sure then that the child is not going to be deprived entirely. That would not prevent, however, if there were a father who was the father of an illegitimate child, if he wished to step in, could do that. And the important thing, it seems to me, is that the children are not deprived.
Yes, you people are so very helpful to me, because that's the next case. Precisely this circumstance that Dr. Schutz is discussing was before the United States Supreme Court just a few years ago. The facts of the case were these. A man and a woman had lived together for 18 years. They had never married each other. They didn't intend to marry each other. It wasn't a mistake or an accident. They didn't intend to marry each other. The man would stay with the woman for 9 months and they would get tired of each other. He'd go away for a few months, then he would come back. Live with her more than he lived someplace else. She lived with him more than she lived alone. During this 18 years, they had a number of children. I've forgotten how many, three or four, something of that sort. And they were, of course, minors still, since their total relationship had only been 18 years. The children, in fact, were fairly young, a couple of them at least. The woman died, a natural death. The state of Illinois, where they lived, has a law that says where a child is left without someone who is legally responsible for that child's welfare, that the child must be protected. You know, children are helpless for a long time after birth. The human child is incapable of self-support for a longer time, I guess, than almost the offspring of any other mammal that we know. So the state of Illinois, feeling its responsibility as the super parent, if you want to think of it that way, had a statute, which said that as soon as a child was left without a legally responsible guardian, that the state would move in and the child would become a ward of the state and the state would care for it. So upon the death of the mother of these illegitimate child, the father, not being legally responsible for their care, and having no legal rights or obligations, found that the children were taken from him and made wards of the state. He said, "You can't take those children from me. They are my children." And the state said, "Why didn't you think of that 18 years ago? If you wanted to have the right, legally enforceable, the right to claim these children, to care for them, to provide for them, to love them, to be responsible for them, you had adequate opportunities. You could have married the mother, or failing that, after the children were born, you could have legally adopted them. Failing that, there are still other avenues that you could have used. Sir, we suspect that your only interest in these children is that you'd like to have them around the house so that you, as the operating parent, can collect aid for a family with dependent children. You're trying to commercially exploit these kids. You don't really love them, because if you did, you would have married the mother or adopted them or taken one of these other avenues. We don't believe you." He said, "I have inherent rights in any child which is my biological child. And you may not Fifth Amendment me. You may not deprive me of my inherent biological rights. Blood is thicker than water. Without first showing that I am such a depraved person, so unfit that the children cannot live with me. Illinois said, get lost, Buster. You don't even have standing to raise that question. You have no legal rights. You are now the United States Supreme Court. The man is before you. He says that's a deprivation of his life, liberty, or property without due process of law. How does that one seem to you, ma'am?
Well, I would say that he's right, but I'm not sure if the law is interpreting that way, because one thing I see is the law interprets that a mother-child relationship is legal, but a father-child relationship is not legal. It seems to me a difference here, and going back to like Stokes-Weber, if it had, the tables had been turned and a husband had been a house person, and the wife had gotten, had been a support, I wonder if, our thinking on responsibility and so forth would be a little bit different. And I wonder if the law has been interpreting it this way, too.
Glonna against Levy, another United States Supreme Court case just before Stokes-Weber, answered your question. The mother, by virtue of maternity, was related, and upon her death, any child, lawful or unlawful, legitimate or illegitimate, had a right. And the law said, functionally, it's a lot easier to tell who a mother is than who a father is. We have less imprecision, the facts are not so difficult. Besides that, somebody's got to be responsible for the child, which incidentally was not always true. A few years before this, in the English and in American law, there was something known as a filius nullius, or in English, nobody's baby. Mm-hmm. Now, outside of wedlock, the bastard, at that point in the development of the law, nobody had any responsibilities. You know, in the glory of the heights of the civilization of Rome, way back in the early Roman days, we are told by historians that in Rome as many as 50 children a night, newborn infants, would be placed in the public square. The family had no obligations. The father in those days was a big man. He had the right of life and death over all of his property. And his property included not only the cows and the pigs and the chickens, but also other kinds of animals like his wife and the children. And so if he wanted to put the kids on the square to die from exposure, fine. It was his business. The family was protected. Inside the family got to make the decisions. Now, from Rome till now, we've had this shift over to, but you have to protect every human being by law, and the family's not doing its job in that protection. So we went through that complete ownership of a child to nobody owns the child, to the mother is responsibility, to Stokes-Weber, where we're trying to see whether or not the time has come to get the father in the act now, too.
Is it the father's name on the birth certificate? I know a mother can claim, I don't know who the father is, and, she'd come to that point. But in this particular case where they had lived together for 18 years, wasn't his name?
Yes, it was.
Well, that would be some form of
ownership. But, of course, a birth certificate is a hearsay document which creates a presumption of paternity, and it's not proof in itself. And even if it is proof, and everybody in this case agreed.
But in this particular case.
They agreed that the man was the father, but they said you are only the biological father. You are not the legal father, and therefore you don't have legal rights. If you want to provide something for the child, happy to have it. But when you come in and claim the child as yours, and we do believe that you're doing that only so that you can get an AFDC check once a month. See, that's the argument that Illinois was making. We, Illinois, are trying to protect this child from exploitation by money-hungry, irresponsible parents. Think once more, ladies and gentlemen, 18 years, this man had the opportunity to marry the mother, thereby making the children legal, adopt them, making the children legal, obtaining a wardship, making the children within his wardship, getting a guardianship, making it possible for him to control. None of that. None of that.
Did he support them all this time during those 18 years, or like you said, he left and came back? left and came back?
He was contributing to their support on and off when he was there, on and off.
Would not the laws of child abandonment in that particular state have some effect on the case?
Yes, he could have been compelled to contribute to the support of these children. You want to follow that by saying, and therefore he has legal rights? See, this is the goose gander argument. If there's one, there's the other. If you make me pay, then I must have rights. Because almost all law is put in terms of reciprocity. You want me to do something nice for you? Do something nice for me. You want me to pay you $5? Do $5 worth of work. You want $5 without doing something for me? What do you think I am, crazy or a Christian? I'm sorry, I missed it.
It seems like he's not even taking part in that reciprocity at all. And I think that's what gets my dander up, is that he didn't enter into the legal system at the beginning by getting married and going through the legal channels at that point. So how does he have any right to come to the legal system now and demand some...
Since there was no support given nor demanded, he shouldn't have any rights.
Yeah, it's like he didn't
That legitimate and illegitimate to me is not a rational classification, and I don't think the children ever should suffer because of the sins of the father. So I would vote that the still serving child gets support to support the legitimate.
So you would say that in both of these cases there is a violation of the 14th Amendment, a denial of equal protection of the law. I take it. Yes, ma'am.
Was he willing to take these poor children because he loved them and was willing to support them without any additional support?
He said that he said that he loved them dearly.
Well, I believe him.
And that he would support them when he had funds, and when he didn't, why, of course, he would expect some assistance from the state.
Well, regardless,
the spirit was willing, but the flesh might have been a little weak.
Regardless of who got the AFDC, or if the children went into foster care, I mean, the state was going to pay one way or another, unless somebody would come along and say, well, now I'm going to adopt this child. There would be not much difference.
Yeah, but you put your finger on the significant point, you see.
It sounds almost like that there was something personal.
Because if the father has to consent to an adoption, and if the father really is making money, if that's his scheme, then if the father keeps control, the state will never be able to place the children out for adoption. And it's not so good for the child, and it's more expensive for the state. So saw the rascal off, you see, is the state's argument. This man, Illinois said, is unworthy of having that kind of control. He's being dog in the manger. That's the argument. I don't mean to say that that's the conclusion that I would reach personally, but that was the state of Illinois' argument. The child needs protection as an individual. This man has not used the normal legal channels for protecting any interest that he wants, and we now suspect only the worst of him.
Does the same situation prevail in many other states?
It's the same. Yes. Before this case in the United States Supreme Court, which is about 4 or 5 years ago now, this was a perfectly typical situation all across the United States. Well, I should tell you now that
there be a presumption of ignorance on his part. I suppose there are some people that are so ignorant.
Could be. It could be that he might be able to show that he was so uninformed that he didn't know that people got married and so forth. And he might even persuade somebody of that.
Why then in cases of welfare, when the mother wants to get some help from the state, that she is forced to say who the father is and write that down, and she is not eligible for welfare until she says who that is, and the reason they have to have that is because they want to get a hold of him. And what kind of rights, I mean, does he have to help support that child, even though they're not legally married? Mm-hmm.
Yes. Formerly only by state law, now by federal law, as well as state law, anybody who is the parent of anybody can be held for support for that child. Now that's a consequence in part of the thrilling finish of this other case, because the United States Supreme Court held in this 18-year non-marital cohabitation that the father did have some rights and he was entitled to be heard before the children could be taken and placed with somebody else. Now that doesn't mean by any means that he's going to necessarily keep the children. It means only that you have to give him a hearing first. You have to listen to him. And if he can in fact show, now we're at the facts, if he can in fact show that he means well for the children, that he intends to take care of them, and that he is a fit person, then he will keep them. If, on the other hand, it can be shown factually that he's unfit, that it's too hard on the children, then the children can, he can be deprived, just as the state could deprive me of my children, even though they were born to my wife and to myself during marriage. If we are so unfit, then the state will protect the child by taking the child out of my custody and placing that child in what is hopefully a better situation. Well, that was the end of that case. And so the holding was that no child can be placed for adoption until you have released the child from the control of both the mother and the father. And what a thunderclap that was in the American law, because for decades it had been known that the fathers of illegitimate children had no rights and they didn't have to be deprived. Suddenly the entire picture changed. The consequence of that has been the enactment in a number of states of what is known as the Uniform Parentage Act. And that act says that there no longer is such a thing as an illegitimate child. Every child is the legitimate child of a man and a woman, no matter whether they're married to each other or not. The child is entitled to the rights of a child against the parents, and they have rights with reference to the child, no matter whether they're married or not. That's another problem. That problem of the marital relationship is still important for a number of things, such as tax and inheritance and so forth, but the legitimacy relationship between the child and the adult parents is now, in a few states that have adopted this act, resolved in favor of legitimacy. Notice what we've done. We have resolved one problem, support and claim of right to custody of the child, by changing the words legitimacy and illegitimacy. We've got all the rest of the range of the problems to be answered out here that have not yet been resolved by that. But we've sort of cast a vote in terms of individual or independent, singular determinations of issues, rather than going at it on a group basis of deciding whether or not there's a family and then answering all of those questions yes, or no family, and all the questions are no. That's another way of voting for individual treatment rather than institutional or group treatment.
Is that individual treatment, or it seems to me in this case the 14th Amendment acts the gate to which people get access to the rights under the 5th Amendment. So that by giving people due process, which is basically what the father gets now, is due process for
that's correct.
Of that.
He gets a hearing, that's right. Correct.
And
due process.
That we acknowledge as a society that there is that this is a problem, and then that we decide either for the individual or the family based on the merits of the case rather than on the merits of the classification.
That's what we're doing. We're doing it on individual, independent basis, case by case, rather than sort of saying that we have a group or a institutional answer for these things. Now, I'd like to just one more footnote on this one. This is a terribly important problem to us. It used to be that most children, still is true, that most children are born to people who are married to each other. However, the birth rate in the United States has been going down very rapidly. It is now as low as it has been any time since 1930. It's going down especially rapidly with people who are married to each other. The birth rate for unmarried people is going up like a skyrocket on 4th of July. One out of 10 children in the state of Washington now is born outside of marriage. As many as 50% of the children in many cities are born to persons who are not married to each other. One out of every girl in the United States will have a child before she's 18 years of age. One out of every 10 girls in the United States will have a child before she is 18 years of, by the time she's 18 years of age. And a great, great percentage of those are going to be born to girls who are not married. The problem we've just been talking about, how to relate that woman, that man, and that child, is a problem of increasing dollar significance, but also a terribly important problem about how is that child to be introduced to our culture, to our beliefs? Who's going to be responsible for training that child, for giving it a model of how to live? I, as a lawyer, cannot answer that for you. I refer you to the wisdom of Mrs. Reiki, who will explain all of that tonight in a session on how to communicate between parents and children, as well as other human beings. My business is only the poverty level. She takes care of Grace in our family.
We had a case in Milwaukee of a young man who his girlfriend became pregnant, and she wanted an abortion. He did not. They weren't married. And he took it to court, but in the meanwhile, she just went off and got an abortion. Now, I don't know what the outcome of that would be, but the thought comes to your mind, when did life begin, and have the court settle?
And what right does the father have to an unborn child?
Yeah.
And we have had an answer to that within the last 9 months in the United States Supreme Court. The woman makes the decision, married or unmarried. The father does not have a right to determine whether or not the mother will or will not abort. That makes you think that he is being deprived of property without due process. But is a child property? Does a mother and a father own a child? I have a feeling in one sense that we left slavery after the Civil War, and that one human being does not own another. Perhaps a husband doesn't really own his wife. What a heretical thought that is. Perhaps a man and a woman do not own the child. Perhaps both women and children are human beings. There, I've done it again. And perhaps they have rights as human beings as well as husbands and fathers.
Has the court settled when life begins as far as an unborn child?
No, ma'am.
There hasn't.
No. It has been held by our courts that an unborn child whose life is terminated by a negligent action before birth is killed under circumstances where a representative of that child can bring an action for wrongful death, thereby saying that there was
pregnancy.
If the child is destroyed by an accident of some sort or a wrongful act, that the child's legal representatives have a cause of action for damages done to the child. Not the child's own action exists before the child is born, not the mother's action or the father's action, the child's own action, thereby suggesting that the law recognizes the existence of a person before birth. Inconsistent? Mm-hmm. Please don't ask the law to be consistent in all of its applications. You must not expect too much of the legal system. It's a poverty plan.
kill itself?
I'm sorry?
I said, can a child kill itself by some action in the womb? I don't mean consciously, but you spoke of it.
I can't answer the physical problem there. The case involved a case in which a pregnant woman was wrongfully attacked and mistreated physically, abused, so that both she and the child were destroyed. The life in the mother, the life in the unborn fetus, both terminated at that point. And the action was wrongful, clearly wrongful, a felonious attack upon them. And an action was found to lie for both the mother and for the child. Now, of course, that has to be distinguished from lawful actions which terminate the existence of any human being. You know, we can lawfully end people's lives. The state of Washington is threatening to do this with a number of people who are sitting in our prisons now. They call it capital punishment. You might think of it as murder. We can terminate people's lives under certain circumstances. A police officer may, under certain circumstances, kill another person in self-defense. Under certain very limited circumstances, you may kill another person in self-defense. I don't advise that very much, but you see, there are circumstances in which death can result legally, lawfully. Whether or not one can ever cause the death of another person morally is an extraordinarily difficult problem, which people my age faced in spades at the time of Pearl Harbor. Prior to 1942, I had never killed a person in my life. Remedied that very shortly thereafter. Now, legally, no question. Morally, spiritually, a problem which tortured me from that day on and continues to, you know, but that's a little bit out beyond and to the side of the particular problem we're addressing now. Ma'am.
This happened to an acquaintance of mine in South Dakota. She was married to a man who, she has three children by, and he was an alcoholic and he beat her and beat the kids. So finally she divorced him and took the children with her. And then she moved in with a woman who eventually became her lover and had the three kids with her. But the man realized what was happening, so he took it to court and he said, I want my three children back. I don't want them living with two lesbians.
Yes.
What do you think the legal action should have been on this?
If it had been in the state of Washington within the last 2 years, she would have lost her children.
To an alcoholic father?
Right.
Or to the state if they felt he wasn't appropriate.
Take it away from the mother and then perhaps turn around and take it away from the father also, on the theory that the state would give the child a better home and better surroundings than either of the biological parents. Legal parents in this instance would give the child.
No decision was ever made on the validity of the capability of that lesbian mother or an alcoholic father, just because a precedent has been set, that's how law continues. Is Peck versus Pepper, Stokes versus whatever?
I think it continues that way because there's a cost involved. Every time the state takes a child, they're going to have to put out money for that. And every time they do that, then the taxes increase and the taxpayers complain. So if there is a parent, fit or not, that can be, or that'll legally take the child, in Wisconsin that seems to be the case. We've seen foster children go back to parents that were dope addicts and alcoholics.
Blood is thicker than water, you see. They protect the institution and the family.
I know of a case
where a
natural father said, well, after all, they're my children, and I want them back. Sure, he wanted them back. He was going to get some money for support.
Notice the heavy overtones of I own the children, they are mine, rather than these children have been given to me as persons that God wants me to love and to cherish and to care for and to provide for. Quite a different environment. We have now come to what is or is very close to being 2 minutes, within 2 minutes of being the end of the time that we have allocated for us for this discussion. And I have a few more pearls to cast.
Russ White, go ahead.
It's funny how quickly Dr. Schramm gets to the end result of these things. I have these comments to make about this. Given the context in which we have just seen these cases developing, that is, the notion is that somebody has to relate to somebody for certain purposes. Care, training, love, protection, support, as well as the need to have some readily workable, you know, practicable institutional forms for deciding questions. Not every one of these questions can be resolved in litigation. You know, if we get to the place where we've got to answer all of our problems by litigation, we are through. As I was telling my good friend here this morning, in Britain, where postal clerks are not permitted to strike, by law, they're not permitted to strike, and those people over there haven't found out about law violation yet, so they don't. When they're not getting enough money, they go to their supervisors and say, unless you pay us more, we're going to follow all the rules. And if they follow all the rules, you know, anytime you get legalistic, they follow all the rules and the mail never does get delivered. Because law in its legalistic wooden forms becomes so mechanical. You know, if every corner has to be turned precisely, that it's even better than a strike. So, now, what we have to do then is to develop a system in which we have patterns and accepted norms for behavior which enable us to act practically. And it's only in the dramatic case, the extreme case, where law can and will intervene and take over. We have some systems. We have something known as the child abuse legislation. When a child is having its arms and legs broken by parents, and those other brutal things which are happening to children in the United States today, and I'm sure you've heard all that you want to hear about that. It sickens one to realize what we are doing to children. When that is discovered, the child can be taken away. That's a pretty clear case, isn't it? When it happens, the parents are not caring for the child, maybe because they can't. A heartbreaking case recently of a man and a woman, best intentions in the world, just not competent. They just didn't have the capacity to care for a child. Take the child away. Protect the child. Now that's the child abuse kind of laws. Then there are the child protection laws. Somebody says, this child is too dirty. This child is not getting enough to eat. And the law in most states says that you don't take the child away, but you work with the parents. You go to the home and say, we are here from your friendly Department of Social and Health Services or public assistance. May we help you? May we teach you how to wash a child? How to prepare nourishing meals for the child? Let us help you with some money if that's your need. Because it's better for the child to be cared by loving parents who can develop the minimum skills that are necessary to care for the child. Child protection, child abuse, child protection, and then finally we have a number of systems like adoptions, foster systems, and other kinds of patterns by which we may provide either permanent or temporary care for children in those situations in which the home situation has collapsed either permanently or temporarily, and some help has to be provided. All of those sorts of determinations involve factual determinations about how seriously does the child have to be suffering. I mean, how inept, question of degree, how depraved must the parents be? You know, how incompetent, how dirty, how undernourished, the extent, the degree. And those are cases that judges don't like to respond to, because it always poses that terribly difficult, marginal, border line of judgment. And they're very hard to review on appeal. An appellate judge has very little information except a dry written record to try and see whether or not the judge in the trial court erred or made a good judgment. These are extraordinarily difficult cases. And so we try to protect against the worst error. And notice that no matter which way you go, you're going to hurt somebody. We try to protect against the worst error by a presumption. And that presumption historically has been, unless the person who wants to remove the child can carry the burden of making the case, the presumption ought to be that the child remains with the family because of our confidence and our wish to keep the family protected as a going unit. In the last 10 years, 15 years, that presumption is shifting. And the presumption now is more and more toward, if it cannot be shown that the individual person, whether it's a child or whether it's an adult that needs care, an incompetent, mentally deficient person or someone else, our presumption is becoming more and more the individual in human being ought to be protected. And unless it can be shown that the system is working to give the protection, then the presumption ought to be in favor of protecting that individual rather than protecting the institution. We haven't heard the end of that. That battle is going to go on for a long time. One thing I can say to you, I think, without any serious doubt about its accuracy, and that is that the United States, or the state of Washington, doesn't make nearly as good a parent as Mrs. Reakey or Mrs. Jones or Mrs. Smith makes. When the family functions, it functions much better than the state or the federal government. Maybe there's some real utility in keeping that family cranked up and trying to protect it. Well, it's a problem we're going to face, because there are going to be more, not fewer, of these cases. It may be pure coincidence, but with the increase in the number of children born out of wedlock, there has also been, at the same time, over the same period of time, an increase in the detected number of child abuse cases. Whether or not one causes the other is, of course, arguable. There is a rule of logic that says just because something happens at the same time, it doesn't mean it happens because of.
Well, it's safer now to report child abuse.
It is safer now. We have better detection systems, and there are lots of other possible explanations. Or perhaps, in fact, it does cause.
They're also keeping their babies.
Yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. Mothers are keeping children born out of wedlock now with much greater frequency. Adoption has slowed down considerably. Used to be that there were more children to be adopted than there were prospective adopting parents. Now it's quite the other way around. A healthy infant on the market will bring as much as $10,000 easily, mm-hmm. because people want quicker delivery than 9 months or something.
Is there a law? It's very evident that a young man or a young woman wouldn't have the capacity to do a decent job of parenting, whereby they can be deprived of their gifts and appropriate.
No, sir. That's thought of as being a deprivation of one of the most essential human rights that there is, the right to marry and the right to procreate. However, notice that we have a great many laws which prohibit marriage, but we're not willing to be quite as draconian, quite as drastic about the right of the attempt to sterilize people. That's thought of as being unconstitutional. a very difficult problem, isn't it? And for those of you who were here a couple days ago when we talked about Red Hale against Zablocki, that is, the prohibition of the right to marry unless certain parental attributes were shown, the United States Supreme Court has decided that that law of Wisconsin was unconstitutional. It's a deprivation of a human right without due process. Now, I'm keeping you over time. I apologize for that. One more commercial. Mm-hmm. You have heard me be very negative, and in the first 2 days, I've asked that you suffer. Because I want you to really understand that law, as nice as it is for some things, really is abject poverty. It's better than bloodshed, it's better than violence, but just barely. I wanted you to feel the depression of the sterility of people relating to each other only legally. I'd like for you to be tortured a little bit with what does Scripture mean when it says, I rejoice in the law of God. You know, your statutes, your ordinances, your laws. I rejoice in these things, you see. The will of God, the law of God, the ordinances of God, the statutes of God. What does that mean, really? And for the next 2 hours that some of us can spend together, I have two topics that I would like to discuss with you. One is, can law really preserve and protect these relationships? Is that a possible job for law? And can we really do something affirmatively as well as just negatively? Talk about that the next time we get together. And then Monday, and I suppose most of you will have gone home by that time and I'll be talking to somebody else. But Monday I would like to talk about when it's necessary to dissolve a relationship, a legal relationship, marriage or otherwise. How should that be done? Should it be done in a spirit of never unless you can really show that somebody is really bleeding? Or should it be done in the sense of if you people don't feel that this legal relationship that you have to each other is helping you, is positive, is useful to you, if you want to get out, get out. Shall we return to Northern Saxony just after Luther, in which the law was that any man and woman who no longer wished to live together could go down and sign the book and their marriage was terminated? Martin Luther, Northern Saxony, a few years after the Reformation. And that's what we'll talk about next Monday. Thank you very much. You've been most patient. I've kept you over time. I apologize for that.